I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday. After a Sunday of worship and displays of racial solidarity, the city of Charleston, South Carolina, prepares for a week of funerals. We talk about the nation's latest mass shooting today with Maryland Congressman Chris Van Hollen and with Charles Ellison, contributing editor of The Root, who sees the Charleston killings as an act of domestic terror. Also joining us, Furman de Brabander, the Baltimore-based author of a new book on guns and freedom, presidential historian Richard Striner of Washington College, Maryland psychiatrist and author Gordon Livingston, and political and cultural commentator Kimberly Moffitt of UMBC. Open phone lines for your comments as well. Charleston, racial hatred and guns in the old Confederacy. That's Midday after the news from NPR. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Midday. Dan Rodericks here. Thanks again for joining us. Nice to be back after a week off. Here we are on WYPR Baltimore again, WYPF Frederick and Western Maryland, WYPO Ocean City and the Eastern Shore, and streaming live through WYPR.org. Last Wednesday night, Dylan Roof, 21-year-old high school dropout with demonstrated and documented hatred of blacks, sat through a Bible study at historic Emmanuel AME Church in Charleston, South Carolina, then opened fire, killing six women and three men, all of them black. Among them was Emmanuel AME's pastor. The Justice Department is investigating this attack as a hate crime. The evidence of the shooter's hatred is clear. On Saturday, what many are calling a racist manifesto was discovered online on a website that is registered to Roof. On the site, Roof appears in photos wearing patches of the apartheid-era South African flag and the flag of white supremacist Rhodesia. In other images, he appears waving a Confederate flag while holding a gun. The photos have revived a longstanding debate about the Confederate flag's display on public buildings and grounds in South Carolina. Hundreds marched in Columbia and Charleston demanding its removal. This racially motivated attack has come at a time when the country is already churning with racially charged debate about police conduct all across the country. And the Bible study massacre raises questions about gun control, but there seems to be little stomach for that fight in Congress or at the White House. We'll get a chance to talk about that today. In a podcast interview released just today, President Obama said the legacy of slavery still casts a long shadow over a nation where race relations have improved over the years. But he also said that racism was still deeply embedded in American society. Here's some of what the president had to say, a warning to listeners. The president uses the N-word in his remarks.
Racism.
Racism. We are not cured of.
Clearly.
And it's not just a matter of it not being polite to say nigger in public. That's not the measure of whether racism still exists or not. It's not just a matter of overt discrimination. We have societies don't overnight completely erase everything that happened 200 to 300 years prior.
Later in this hour, we hope to hear from Congressman Chris Van Hollen of Maryland and presidential historian Richard Striner to talk a little bit about President Obama's remarks today and his remarks last week about this massacre in Charleston. Joining me in the studio now are three guests returning to our midday program: Furman de Brabander, a philosophy professor at the Maryland Institute College of Art, who joined us just 2 weeks ago to discuss his book, Do Guns Make Us Free?, newly published by Yale University Press. Do Guns Make Us Free? Democracy and the Armed Society. Furman de Brabander, welcome back to Midday.
Thank you.
Also with us today, Charles Ellison, contributing editor for The Root and Washington correspondent for the Philadelphia Tribune. On Friday, Charles wrote an op-ed in The Root called, "Let's Call Charleston Shooting What It Was, a Terrorist Attack." We'll hear more from Charles today about his views on this attack. Charles, nice to have you back with us.
Dan, good to be here. Thanks for having me.
And Kimberly Moffitt is back with us, too. I'm happy to say, associate professor of American Studies at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, and co-author a few years ago of The Obama Effect. Kimberly joins us here on Midday from time to time to talk about politics, media, and culture. Kimberly, nice to have you back.
Thank you.
So I was away when this occurred, a little bit of vacation, so my first opportunity to hear from you and our listeners about what happened in Charleston and all that we've learned since this shooting, another mass shooting last Wednesday night. So, Kimberly, why don't I start with you, and then we'll hear from Charles and Furman. First, your thoughts about what's occurred here in the last few days and the president's remarks this morning.
Yeah, I'll respond immediately to the president's comments.
Go.
Because I think it's interesting. I had a similar response to his comment about the N-word as the debate that has ensued around the Confederate flag flying in South Carolina, in particular at the State House, that it is an important issue by all means, but I think it's a tangential issue that can sometimes divert our attention away from what the real issue is, which are issues of race and racism. And so pulling down the flag certainly takes away a particular symbol, but it doesn't deal with what the root issue is, which is how people are acting upon what they think about race issues or racism, and instead taking away from individuals' humanity in terms of seeing them as a full person and human and treating them that way, and instead saying, oh, but this flag represents so much, which it does, but it doesn't need to be our focal point. What needs to be our focal point is why do we even have these issues sitting in young people, a 21-year-old individual, a college student, someone that could be in my college classroom, who is harboring these types of beliefs and feelings towards an entire race of people and then taking the move to act upon it? That's a bigger concern to me than our focal point on the flag right now.
On the president's remark, use of the N-word by the president of the United States, this might be unprecedented, at least in public in a setting like that, in an actual interview. It's kind of jarring.
It is, but I also think, and Furman and I had this conversation before coming on air, that we think is very much a part of what happens for a second-term president who is in a space now to be able to share some of what is the reality of what's coming, what's going on in our country.
And he did, I believe he made reference to it in one of his book, Words from My Father.
Right.
But this is actually here. It's spoken by the president. Mm-hmm. Your reaction to that, Charles, and also, you know, all the events of the last few days.
Yeah, and his use of the N-word, it brought to mind that really hilarious Louis C.K. bit with the N-word. I don't know if you all have seen that stand-up that Louis C.K. said where he's like, why do you say the N-word? Because you know that's we're thinking that word, so stop saying the N-word and just say it. Mm-hmm. So in a sense, it was somewhat refreshing that the president would just be candid and just be sort of real talk straight up. You know, this is the word, I'm going to use it. And this is, and try a bit clumsily so, trying to give some very candid reflections on race. I mean, the president was trying to do three things here. I mean, one, he was trying to have that frank discussion or conversation on race. He was also trying to make somewhat of a distinction between the conversation on race and racism. Two very different separate conversations here, because, and that's really the discussion on racism is the conversation that, frankly, we don't like to have, because then that gets into issues of systemic challenges that underserved historically populations of color have faced for about several hundred years now. And he's trying to inject, you know, some of those challenges, some of that history into the discussion. He's also, in a sort of clumsy way, he's been trying to do it for the past few days now, make that linkage between guns and race, because there is, not because it was just this one white guy who committed an act of domestic terrorism and killed nine people, but because you see the data, you see the polls, the surveys, 81% of whites support gun ownership. Nearly half of whites support open carry laws. There's some sort of white cultural or political imperative which makes guns sort of the center of their political existence and why they vote the way they do. And that's something we have to examine. I think the president's trying to examine that, but he's doing it somewhat clumsily.
On that same topic, we'll move to Furman de Brabander, who just wrote a book about guns, spent the last couple of years researching and thinking about guns in our society. And in this case, mass shooting, if this had been a mass shooting in a, you know, there's been so many of them. I looked at the list that Mother Jones published, and it's longer than you might think. There have been more of these kinds of shootings than we thought. But this one has this other element of clearly stated racial hatred. by the shooter. So I guess that makes it a little different. In some respects, it's like a lot of other mass shootings of innocent people with somebody who's got a gun and wants to do damage to and kill others.
Absolutely. And I mean, I think, unfortunately, the president's cynicism is correct. If the Sandy Hook shooting could not change the national dialogue on guns, I find it hard to believe that this one as well. And in fact, the gun rights movement, their immediate response was that we need more guns in churches and pastors need to be armed. And Reverend Pinckney was blamed by an official of the NRA for trying to pass a bill making guns in churches illegal.
Because so, he's a state senator in South
that's
Carolina.
That's correct. Yes,
well.
He is. He's a state senator. And what I would say is, I was reading this morning, South Carolina is home to 19 hate groups, including two factions of the KKK and four white nationalist organizations. That's a noxious mix with easy access to firearms. When you throw easy access to firearms on top of that, that's what you get.
410-662-8780 is our phone number here, the Midday Show. Open phone lines with our guest, Furman de Brabander, who is just speaking, joining us from the Merrill Institute College of Art, where he's a professor of philosophy and author of Do Guns Make Us Free? Kimberly Moffitt from UMBC and Charles Ellison of the Ellison Report is with us in the studio. In your op-ed, you refer to this as domestic terrorism.
Right.
Give us your argument for that.
It is. I think that, particularly the initial reaction to the event, calling it a hate crime, I think it diminishes the magnitude of it. I think it's not a hate crime. It's an act of domestic terrorism. There are a lot of pundits, a lot of politicians, a lot of white cable network anchors that want to call it a hate crime because it didn't affect them, it didn't impact them. But you had the shooter pick a target of strategic value. It's of strategic value in a particular community. It's a center of political, cultural, social, even economic life there in the black community within Charleston. The shooter is acting out. He's leaving a witness alive to tell his story, to tell what happened. It's no different from an ISIL video, no different from a Boko Haram video. You know, it's sort of the same thing where they have to make a big spectacle out of this act of terrorism. And also, we've had acts of domestic terror on U.S. soil in recent months. I mean, last month we had the two young men who shot at the Muhammad Cartoon Convention, and it was a quick rush to describe that as terrorism. There have been acts of domestic terror for a long time, since really before the beginning of the United States. In fact, I think there's actually, and I reference it in the book, there's a very copious history about the historical roots of American terrorism since like the 17th century, and black folks have bore the brunt of that. For example, I mean, back in 1921, we had the infamous attack on Tulsa, Oklahoma, on what's called Black Wall Street. 3,000 African Americans were killed. That was actually the first act of terrorism, pre 9/11 act of terrorism, that a lot of us just sort of conveniently forget about. So when we call it a hate crime, and when the federal government charges this individual as a hate crime perpetrator, it just sort of does not acknowledge how significant this act was, how politically motivated it was, and how it was an act of
terrorism. Furman, do you concur with that?
Absolutely. Actually, I'm looking at an article I pulled here from the New York Times. There was a recent survey done just last week, June 16th. They asked law enforcement agencies. 74% reported that anti-government extremism as one of the top three terrorist threats in their jurisdictions. Only 39% listed extremism connected with Muslim terrorists. And this piece goes on to point out that there have been far more domestic terrorist attacks from right-wing terrorists, anti-government types, sovereign citizen types, in the country since, and they dwarf the amount of Muslim terrorism. And this is something that is not picked up on by the media. But of course, I would just point out the NRA is all too happy to fan the flames of fear about international terrorism. They point to ISIS. They point to Al-Qaeda coming across the border. These are reasons we need guns, and yet they're ignoring the domestic terrorism right here.
Well, and I think it's important, because I agree with both of my colleagues this morning, but I think it's important the role that race plays in all of that. And so how the media decides to construct that for us is to suggest that terrorists can only look a particular way. Mm-hmm. And so if I don't mention Mr. Roof being connected to terrorism, then it makes it easier for me to always have my attention focused in on this particular group of people who do look like so-called terrorists. But if race becomes an issue, which it always is at the center of this conversation, but I have to then think about a white male as a terrorist, that screws with our head. Mm-hmm. And we have no way of being able to wrap our heads around the fact of a white male being a terrorist. So let me then limit the conversation to being about hate crime instead of it being about domestic terrorism.
Looking at it in retrospect, I mean, lynch mobs were terrorist mobs, were they not? That's the
Correct.
Same type of terrorism. It falls from that same tree, doesn't it?
It was very easy for the post-Civil War Reconstruction era Congress to officially designate the Ku Klux Klan as a domestic terrorist organization. This is back in the late 19th century, mm-hmm. right? So, but here we are in 2014, and we have issues with calling these folks, people like Roof and also white supremacist organizations, which actually expanded a bit during recession, domestic terror organizations. You have arguably the most prominent geopolitical analyst firm on the planet, Stratfor. It's called the Shadow CIA, and it advises the American government on geopolitical, military, foreign affairs routinely. They called Charleston a domestic terror event. There was a briefing Stratfor put out hours after, the next day, right after the Charleston event, and they said this is a reminder of domestic terrorism. They also talked about how domestic terrorism is something that actually lone wolf acts of terror is something that the Ku Klux Klan had refined long before jihadists in the Middle East.
The idea that you don't have to belong to a group or
exactly.
be operating
the
in
Ku
a group.
Ku Klux Klan refined that. They're the ones who are sort of the OGs, so to speak, of terrorism. And so the history is there.
Gotcha. That's Charles Ellison, also with us, Kimberly Moffitt and Furman de Brabander. We've got to take a break here. In a little while, we'll be joined by Congressman Chris Van Hollen. But just up ahead, presidential scholar Richard Striner of Washington College reflects on President Obama's response to the mass shootings at Charleston. We'd like to hear from you as well. Please feel free to join our conversation today, the first opportunity we've had on Midday to talk about this. 410-662-8780. Toll-free long distance, 866-661-9309. And welcome back to the Midday Show. Dan Rodericks here with Kimberly Moffitt, Charles Ellison, and Furman de Brabander. Before we go on, a few words from Richard Striner, who also a regular guest here on Midday, professor of history at Washington College, author of several books on presidents, including President Lincoln. He is a Lincoln scholar. And we asked Richard to join us from time to time for some historical perspective on current events. And here we have President Obama, his reaction to another mass killing that occurred during his time in the White House, and making remarks today about racism in the United States and the long shadow of slavery, the legacy of slavery and Jim Crow. Richard Striner, welcome back to Midday. Richard, are you there?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes. I'm glad you're there. Richard, thank you again for joining us. Your thoughts about the president's remarks today in particular, since these are fresh and kind of jarring to some people to hear the president use the N-word in public. Your thoughts about this?
Well, I think he handled the situation just fine. I agree with every single thing he said. It's grim commentary that our first African-American president has been called upon during his presidency to, as an African-American, address an issue like this. He handled it with appropriate anger, but also with his inimitable self-control and judiciousness. I am 64. I grew up during the 1960s. I remember vividly the events swirling around the passage of the Civil Rights Act of 64, Voting Rights Act of 65. And I've often commented to students and others that in the course of my life, it's been truly uplifting to see how far in many ways this nation has come and the degree to which in many strata of American society, people of different racial backgrounds mix easily with very little, if any, apparent emphasis on their racial identity. Racial intermarriage proceeds apace. Popular entertainment is rife with shows in which white and black characters interact in various ways, dramatic, comical, in which race may or may not be a factor. But if it is, it's used for light comedy as often as not. And yet, during the Obama presidency, a number of people, including my wife, said, you know, I think a lot of this consistent sabotage of Obama's program is racially motivated. I said, well, I suppose that's possible, but really, I think a lot of other factors are far more important than that. And now I'm not so sure. In fact, I'm quite prepared to say, in light of the events of the last year, I'm shocked to say that I think they had it right to a great extent, and I was not giving, I was perhaps engaging in too much triumphalism as to how far we've come. It's sickening to see events like this happen.
I mentioned earlier, Richard, this long list of mass shootings that was published by Mother Jones, and many of them occurred on Mr. Obama's watch here since 2009, his inauguration. And we had Sandy Hook, the massacre at Newtown, and a Congress unwilling to do anything about that. And now it seems like the president, you know, he says something like, we need to face the fact that we have more of this kind of gun violence than any other Western nation. But he doesn't seem to be willing to do much more about it here in his second term, nor can he, maybe, with this particular Congress.
Well, he can't, not with this Congress,
yeah.
And not with the tremendous, brutal power that the NRA exerts upon American politics. These are two separate but overlapping issues, because a lot of this gun violence has no necessary race connection at all, but some of it does. And absolutely, this country is absolutely out of control when it comes to the sickening ease with which maniacs can get their hands on deadly weapons. And there are plenty of responsible, sane gun owners, I'm sure, who would be quite willing to submit to a sensible system of regulation to keep firearms out of the hands of lunatics. But for decades and decades, the NRA has been hijacked by some belligerent gun nuts for whom this has some sort of primeval symbolism. I don't know exactly why. I don't want to know. But they have got this astonishing amount of power to just kill any attempt at any sensible legislation. It's another horrible fact about America.
Richard Schreiner, thank you very much for being with us today.
You're very welcome.
Richard Schreiner of Washington College. Yeah, Furman de Brabander. Why does that translate into so much political power for the NRA? How does that happen?
Well, because they have clout, and you know, of course, there's that. But also, they have been the NRA has been so successful in making their position non-negotiable for candidates who want to brand themselves conservatives. If you want to be a conservative and run as a conservative, you may not defy them. And in fact, wasn't it Governor Nikki Haley in South Carolina? She did not stand during the applause. There was an event in commemorating the victims, and someone called for universal background checks or gun control, and there was a standing applause, and she stayed seated down with her hands in her lap because, for fear, she is branded as someone who is not quite as not sufficiently conservative. The NRA has an up or down vote on that.
Can we just break down again a little bit what you found in terms of race and support for gun control?
Well, the support for gun control has been historically much higher among African Americans than among whites. But when I was on your show last, I mentioned that there had been one recent Pew Research Council report. Not a very huge polling group. I think it was about 1,500 people. But they found for the first time that a majority of African Americans now said they felt that gun ownership was more important than gun control. And some commentators had speculated that that may have been a result of the very high-profile police shootings that have involved unarmed African Americans. And in fact, one member of Martin Luther King's group had said, and to much controversy, had said that African Americans need to start arming themselves if these kinds of attacks continue. But that link was unclear.
People who live in areas most affected by gun crime support more gun control. People who live in areas that are virtually untouched by violent crime, at least at the level we see in urban areas, are opposed to almost anything and want to be able to carry weapons. That's what the polls seem to indicate, right? That's where the split is.
Right. You do see that. You have a governor like Nikki Haley. She's an avid gun enthusiast also. She just signed a bill into law back in February that allowed concealed carries or concealed weapons in restaurants and bars, and then was prepared to sign a bill. It failed in the South Carolina State Senate. A bill that would have allowed for permitless concealed weapons. So you could walk around the state of South Carolina with a weapon, without a permit. And that was about to happen, and Haley about to sign that. And so there is a, you do have not only the NRA having, exercising quite a substantial amount of clout on Capitol Hill, whether it's monetary or political clout in D.C. on Capitol Hill, but also exercising quite a bit of political muscle in Republican primaries and using the gun issue as a litmus test for Republican incumbents and also for up-and-coming rising Republican candidates. So there is this, gun, we are seeing a reverse, too. In the 80s and 90s, there was a lot more support for gun control. I think it was around like 26% or so, where people, I think at the time, were saying, we don't support gun ownership, and now it's totally flipped. Yeah. I mean, it's now nearly half of Americans say, I trust Americans with individual Americans with guns and owning them and using them, and also growing increasing numbers of people saying, and this is driven primarily by white voters.
This is a lost cause then. This
is a lost cause. It is.
If there's a litmus test out in the red states, in the red counties, the red congressional districts, right? So that has to stay there.
When you look at the South and West.
Even when you look at Democrats, they're not so hot on this anymore either. They stay away from it, right? Yeah. There's been barely a word mentioned about gun control in the wake of Charleston. Now, there's been a lot of talk about the Confederate flag in Charleston, and I want to go back to Kimberly Moffitt's opening comments on that, because I think it's interesting that you have that reaction. A lot of us hate the Confederate flag, hate to see it, and resent people who display it. I mean, let's be honest, a lot of us do feel that way. But nothing's ever done about it. It's a free country, right? You can't imagine Congress or a state legislature passing a law saying you cannot display the Confederate flag. And yet, here it is in the state where this crime occurs, this massacre of innocent people at a prayer meeting occurs. And it says, is anything going to shift out of this? Anything? I'll give you that maybe gun control is a lost cause, but we'll come back to Furman on that. He doesn't believe it is. But and what about this? You think this is, you said ancillary.
Yeah, issue. I think there may be something positive coming out of this in terms of the hashtag take the flag down. I see that quite a bit on Twitter. And so I think there may be some momentum behind it where folks start to think maybe this is something that we should move away from, especially it being one of the images that represents the entire state of South Carolina. But again, for me, it doesn't take away what the real issue is that's happening in South Carolina, in Baltimore, wherever in this country, that we're still dealing with the issue of race and racism and a structure that is in place in this country that allows people to carry out actions towards individuals that they have a problem with and see as not being for humans. And so for me, I see it as ancillary because I don't want to exert my energy there. That's not what I think will resolve things. Even if the flag comes down tomorrow, where are we?
Where would you put your energy then?
Well, I think there needs to be, where I spend my energy now is trying to talk to my students and educate them on what the power structures are that exist in American society that implicitly are embedded in ways where we carry out certain actions in life that impact other groups of people in very negative ways. Mm-hmm. And the list goes on and on.
Right,
absolutely. So we can talk about housing policies. We can talk about public education. We can talk talk about, you know, I mean, a wide range of issues, legal and judicial system, and how that inadvertently or negatively affects people of color in this country. Those are the issues that I think students in particular, who are our young, need to have access to and to see in order to understand how problematic the actual structure is.
I'm totally with you. I'm just thinking of the white supremacist who lives someplace in the South, maybe South Carolina, where that flag waves on the public grounds at the public at the Capitol, and thinks, you know, that's a wink, that's a big wink toward me to continue on my white supremacist ways.
And real quick, I don't want to suck up too much oxygen here with that, so I can
go
to but. I'm rather cynical about this whole take the flag down effort, and I agree with Kimberly on this point. It doesn't translate into, or the question, the big question is, does it translate into political power for black folks who live in South Carolina
to get that flag down?
When they take the flag down, I mean, is that going to translate into long term substantive political power? And here's the thing. Here's the other thing too, is that some fairly hard headed folks in South Carolina, right? We've been there, done that before with a boycott of the state or a so-called boycott of the state, trying to take the flag down. And at the end of the day, it's not what they're trying to do, you know, using. And I understand what activists and I understand what Democrats are trying to do, use this issue as a rally point to kind of mobilize the electorate there in South Carolina. But at the end of the day, less than 2% of African Americans are present in the South Carolina Republican primary, right? And that's honestly, that's only the only way that I actually see the flag being taken down is if suddenly you had this massive shift, like in Mississippi with Thad Cochran's Senate race, right? Where you suddenly have a bunch of African American voters there in South Carolina who suddenly register as Republican or participate in the Republican primary and pose an existential threat to those legislators on the state, local, and federal level who support the rebel flag or that flag flying. Until then, it's just going to continue to fly.
The philosophy professor is dying to comment on the existential threat. Go right ahead for a
minute. Actually, it's a much more mundane point. I was going to say, I agree. I think that it would be great to take down the Confederate flag. I just know that the NRA is very happy that the conversation is not about guns. Let's make it about racism. Let's make it about the Confederate flag. Anything but guns.
Yes.
That's their pattern throughout.
We have to take another break here. When we get back, Chris Van Hollen will be joining us, the congressman, to talk about Handgun Purchaser Licensing Act of 2015. This is very interesting. Johns Hopkins Center for Gun Policy and Research had a study that shows a correlation between requiring a license to purchase a handgun and substantial reduction in firearm homicides. In Connecticut, for instance, a license to purchase a firearm has been required since 1995, and Hopkins researchers have associated that law with a 40% decrease in firearm homicides over the 20 years since it went into effect. Along those lines, we'll be talking with Congressman Van Hollen after this short break here on Midday. And welcome back to the Midday Show. Dan Rodericks here, along with our guests, Furman de Brabander from MICA, Maryland Institute College of Art, author of Do Guns Make Us Free, a new book from that was published in May by Yale University Press, Charles Ellison, contributing editor of The Root, the Ellison Report, and Kimberly Moffitt from the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. Chris Van Hollen, Congressman Van Hollen, joining us here for a few minutes to talk about, well, what happened in Charleston and the gun element of this story. Chris Van Hollen, thank you very much for joining us on the Midday Show.
Dan, it's great to be with you. Thanks.
Yes. You know, we had some conflicting reports about how the alleged shooter in this case got the gun that he used or came into possession of a handgun. One report had his parents giving him money at the age of 21 and his going out to buy the gun himself. Another report had the father purchasing the gun and giving it to the son as a present. And either way, there's something missing in all that transaction that I guess your legislation would address.
Well, as you said, Dan, we don't know all the specific factors in this particular case. So it's not clear whether the permit to purchase law would have prevented this person from getting the gun. But what we do know is what you said at the opening of this segment, which is that the Johns Hopkins just did a study showing that states that adopt laws that require a permit to purchase have seen a huge drop in homicides by firearm. Connecticut, as you indicated, saw a 40% drop. And in the state of Missouri, which used to have that kind of law but then repealed it, they saw a big jump in homicide by firearm. So this Hopkins study is important because it shows the facts, it's got the evidence, and it seems to me that common sense people from across the political spectrum and ideological spectrum should agree that we should follow the science. After all, you've got to get a permit to drive a car. Why not say that you should have a permit before you can purchase a gun? That will help keep guns out of the hands of dangerous people. It won't stop every awful incident and tragedy, but we know from the Hopkins study that it will make a huge difference.
Will the act provide some funds to the states to encourage the states to go along with these laws, or will it actually be a federal law?
This provision, the bill we introduced, is a bill to encourage other states to adopt the kind of laws that Connecticut passed some time ago and that Maryland passed more recently. And the reason it's in Maryland's interest to encourage other states to do this is that while we will definitely reap some benefit, as Connecticut has, in terms of homicide reductions from firearms, the reality is that many of the guns today sold in Maryland come from out of state. And therefore, if we can have more states participate in this kind of law, then those states that have done the smart thing, like Maryland and Connecticut, won't be victims of the fact that other states have not been as responsible.
The Handgun Purchaser Licensing Act of 2015. So what is the status of that bill?
Well, it's been introduced. You know, my view, Dan, is that we need to build a growing coalition around the country in support of some of these common sense measures. We saw after the awful Newtown a tragedy that the American public overwhelmingly supported universal background checks to see if people have a criminal record or otherwise are a danger to the community. And after Charleston, you would hope that we would really begin to focus on this again, this senseless gun violence. Again, the issue isn't whether any particular provision will stop every single act. The issue is what the Hopkins study showed, which is that there are things that we can do to dramatically reduce death by gun violence. And the fact that we're not doing them is gross negligence. So I'm hoping this will be part of the conversation during the 2016 elections, both Senate elections and presidential elections. The country really needs to move forward on these common sense measures.
Thank you very much for your time today, Congressman Chris Van Hollen.
Thank you.
Thank you for being with us. Also, of course, a candidate for the Senate seat being vacated in 2017 by Barbara Mikulski. Yeah, Maryland has a law similar to the one that was passed in Connecticut in 1995, requiring you to go through some training to get a permit to purchase a gun so that we know who you are, and to reduce straw purchases by others. Second party. Right? To close the so-called loopholes, the gun show loopholes, the private purchases loopholes. And we get more information about what happened in South Carolina. In one of these scenarios, there was a failing. This young man was also had a felony charge against him, too, at the time the gun was purchased. 410-662-8780. Let's go to the phone lines for our guests, Furman de Brabander, Charles Ellison, and Kimberly Moffitt. Jim in Towson. I'm sorry. Hold on, Jim. You stay right there. Dan in St. Michael's first. He's been holding longer.
Hi. Yeah, I'm St. Michael's. I'm also Baltimore. I just have a couple of quick things. One is, I'm saddened, truly, that this discussion of this terrible tragedy is discussed in race. Because we are not a racist society. We do have some people who are racist. We're always going to have people who hate other people for all kinds of reasons. But our society has moved so far. And we have a black man president, President Obama, and he would not be a president if the white vote had not supported him. He won and has by a similar margin as most presidents. There's going to be people against him, just like there are people against Democrats and Republicans. On policies, and We gotta be accepting of that and be tolerant of that. This guy was a sick individual. He was a racist, but he came from a state with an Indian descendant governor, with a black senator. And they didn't have riots. We are not a racist society. We have racists. We have hate. But we do need to at least recognize how far we've come as a society. And the second thing is the gun. He used a gun that is very common in a household for protection. Or it wasn't an assault rifle. It wasn't some of these weapons that I got to say, you know, you have to wonder why you need a magazine weapon.
Okay. All right. First on, this is not a racist country. We have racist people. Mm-hmm. Do you want to take that on?
Well, I mean, and I'm glad the caller said that and called in to say that, because, you know, once again, it goes back to that earlier discussion about race versus racism, and the society right now is just having some trouble wrapping its head around the institutional contours of racism or seeing race. See, right now, folks are seeing racism as somebody says something that hurts your feelings.
Right.
You know, you say the N-word.
Like the president
or,
said,
you know, you know, that NBA owner, it was the guy who owned the Clippers, he said something like so foul about the black players on his team. And they think that that's just racism. They're not seeing, you know, these very pernicious, these long-lasting disparities and inequities.
Look, resistance to affordable housing.
Right, the poverty,
there's one we've discussed.
Unemployment. Right.
We've discussed that on the show here. What is that about?
Right.
What is it about that when states and governors in states resist Medicaid expansion under the Affordable Care Act?
Right.
What is that about?
Or the condition of public education and how whether the disparities that exist in districts that are largely people of color versus districts that are largely white. I mean, all of that shows you a systematic process that's been put in place to disadvantage some populations versus others.
Right. Do you see racism in the resistance to gun control?
Absolutely. I mean, there is, you know, the reports of the huge sales in guns with every time Obama won his election. I mean, I think a lot of that was driven by race.
And I think that's an important part that Furman is raising, which I know he probably has the stats better than I do. But we also know the Southern Poverty Law Center reports that the rise of hate groups
absolutely
proliferated during the last 10 years.
Absolutely.
And that's very much tied to the presence of someone like Obama being the face of our country. And it's important to note, even though I appreciate Dan's willingness to offer his perspective, it's important to note that just because the face of our politicians start to change doesn't mean the structure changes.
Not,
it means simply that the face of the politician is implanted into the structure and is now carrying out much of what is already in place.
Here's a comment by email from Tom, who says nearly all America's mass shooters have been young white males, whether they are motivated by politics, racism, personal resentments, or some witch's brew of the above. These young guys think they are entitled to some status they are not achieving. They shoot the people whom they blame for their grievances in the context of their particular worldviews. The growing racist activism and rhetoric in this country, coupled with pro-gun propaganda, gives these guys a rationale, a direction, and the means to act on their testosterone-driven hostilities. Our email address here is midday@wypr.org.
And they're surviving their interactions with police as well.
The white guys
with political chips on their shoulders, who are fully armed, full metal jacket. They survive when police finally engage them. They survive, whether it's the Aurora movie theater shooter or even Dylann Roof.
Well, and not only survive, but then they also get Burger King brought into them because they were hungry, right?
You see the difference in treatment.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. And I also think it's important to note the role social media plays in all of this and how that supports much of what we see occurring. I mean, in terms of giving people immediate access to certain mindsets and philosophies and ideologies that they can then act upon. I think about even...
You're talking about racism in social media?
Absolutely.
It's all over the place.
Absolutely.
It's infested with it.
Absolutely. I mean, even in terms of my own Facebook feed, again, I'm from North Carolina, so I have interactions with old friends in North Carolina, and I remember seeing one of my very conservative high school friends who posted an image that a Virginia church had outside of its, on its marquee outside of the church that read, "Please remember, Satan was the first to demand equal rights." That was the response. So think about what that festers among people the moment you are linking some kind of religious ideology to folks who want to actually be treated the same and equitably as other human beings, that we would then try and not believe that social media is helping to proliferate much of what we understand.
Jack in Reisterstown, our next caller. Go right ahead, Jack.
Yes, sir. Long-time fan. Don't necessarily agree with all you guys on some of this issue, but I wanted to say just a couple of really brief things. One, it is both a hate crime and domestic terrorism. They're not mutually exclusive. And I think anyone with any sense in this country knows that, that what happened is terrible. But what I really called to talk about was that I am an ethnic minority. I am a gun owner. I take my gun with me legally to my place of worship for just a case like this. I think that in any case where you're have the ability to be targeted by someone crazy, you have the need to defend yourself. And while I would love to think that we could take the guns away from these people who are crazy and not take them away from people who want to defend themselves, every one of these cases shows that, that the police aren't going to get there in time in order to save your life if you're sitting in that room.
Jack,
and that
Jack,
you have to protect
excuse me,
yourself.
I need to ask you this. You take a weapon to a gun to your place of worship?
Legally, yes, sir.
You have a concealed carry permit?
Yes, I do.
Do you have permission to take it into a place of worship?
Yes, I do.
In the state of Maryland?
It's private property.
You fear what? You are fearing a terrorist attack at your place of worship?
Well, or a case like this. I mean, we're calling this terrorism, so I would say yes. At any time, someone who in a minority could be targeted by one of these people. It's relatively rare, but when it happens, it's terrible.
Do you mind telling us what minority you are?
Rather not, in this case.
All right, Jack.
Better off if people don't know. You know what I mean?
Okay. All right. Furman, I'd like to hear from you on that.
Well, I mean, we absolutely can reduce the number of guns out there and whose hands they get into. We have absolutely no political will in following through. The ATF has been completely rendered toothless by the NRA's efforts through Congress. We have a private transaction loophole when it comes to background checks. The list goes on and on. And there's 300 million guns out there. If we reduce the number of guns and if we got serious about controlling who gets their hands on them, then that would make the likelihood far less that certain crazy people would get them.
I don't know if I'm
still sitting here thinking about somebody taking a gun to where they worship God. You know?
I'm not going to Jack's church.
Yeah,
so, I mean, that's the first thing that comes to mind. But also, Jack is probably also a reflection. Is a reflection of a certain segment of the electorate that President Obama spoke about back in the 2008 election when he was candidate Obama, about folks clinging to their guns and their religion. I mean, that's actually a very very blatant case of that, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I do think that on a lot of levels, I think that 2016 will prove to be something of a guns election, and we're seeing we're seeing this volatile mix of the gun issue percolating amongst Republican primary voters, and also this fear of ISIL, that somehow ISIL is going to hopscotch across the Mediterranean and Atlantic and start attacking people on their doorstep, and Jack is an example of that. But that's very powerful. Republican candidates, the Republican Party is going to tap into that. And I think it's going to be very powerful, especially I think that Republican voters are, there are signs that Republican voters could be more mobilized than Democratic voters in the 2016 election. And guns will be motivating them.
So as Jack says, he doesn't believe the police can get there in time to help you. So the message you're suggesting is that they will say that our army can't get there to help you.
Right.
Homeland Security can't
get
do it.
Help you. So I'll take care of it.
So arm yourself. So that may be a theme.
That's scary. Especially when you put racism, you throw that into the mix.
It's scary to think about having to take a gun to church with you, or people thinking that they do.
Mm-hmm.
Gee, our hour is up. Is it? We have to take a break here for the news and get some lunch from Rosina Gourmet, provided lunch for us today. But I want to thank Kimberly Moffitt.
Thank you.
Who will be back with us again tomorrow for another hour of our show on Midday Politics. Charles Ellison of the Ellison Report.
Thanks.
And The Root. Your essay is on our Facebook page for our listeners to find.
Thank you, Dan.
Furman de Brabrande, thank you again for being here today. Do Guns Make Us Free is Furman de Brabrande's book, Democracy in the Armed Society.